Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
My tact in these things is usually to get out of the way very quickly, but I have enjoyed reading this book and also the conversation that has created with it. And by this book, I mean Lives in Ruins, Archaeologists and the Seductive Lure of Human Rubble. What tonight's author has done in this book, as she has done in the previous two books, one looking at librarians, one looking at obituary writers, is basically getting in the shoes and getting in the lives of people that we know a little bit something about, or certainly you encounter in different walks of life, but you don't, for whatever reason, we didn't take that path. So this is a great way of kind of getting to know a different career path that just wasn't available to us. And she's such a great writer. After years of being a journalist, one for in magazines primarily, I guess, with Life magazine, but also as an editor at Outside and Esquire, the two that come to mind for me right off. But she does such a great job of just helping us get into the lives of these folks. An archaeologist, as I was talking with our own event coordinator who majored in archaeology, is like one of those really interesting fields where the people there are really, yeah, they have a depth of knowledge and a passion for what they do, but they also, there's a territoriality about things because everybody wants to be there with the fine, but at the same time, the work is just so hard that you really don't want to let it go. I mean, if you're close, you don't want somebody just to jump in, and there's those folks who want to jump in and just find treasures. And yeah, very, very competitive field with a whole lot of hard work. But let me get out of the way and I'll let Marilyn talk about it. So please join me in welcoming Marilyn Johnson.
Thank you for that lovely introduction. And welcome to all of you. I think I know most of the audience. So I have little reminder cards when I speak. And the first reminder card has three names on it: Joan Rivers, Louis C.K., and Studs Terkel. So I'd like to start by saying that as Joan Rivers once said to Louis C.K., what we do is not a job. What we do is a calling. And those are the kinds of people that I'm interested in. I'm interested in people not who are going to have a job where they're making a lot of money and there are many other rewards. I'm interested in jobs where people are passionate about their pursuit to the point where sometimes they are really making considerable sacrifices to do it. This is the case with obituary writers. This is the case with librarians and archivists. And it's certainly the case with archaeologists. I think they have a few other things in common. I think that they're also great at collecting bits of our cultural memory and connecting us with our past, with our civilized past. When I was in poetry school, for I did not go to journalism school, I went to poetry school, I used as a textbook a book that some of you might know called Working by Studs Terkel. And I still remember some of the voices in this book. And I use it to teach voice because that's a very difficult concept to get across to students. And I remembered in particular the voice of Dolores Dante, who was a waitress, who described how she would weave her way between tables with grace, conscious grace. She did not want anyone not to know that she felt like she was on a stage. And she said, if I drop a fork, I pick it up as if there were an art to picking up the fork. And, you know, well, that really impressed me because, you know, the woman could talk, but also because I realized something with this particular oral history, that people could be very eloquent about their work. When they were describing the process of what they were doing, you got to hear some amazing things that you didn't know if you weren't doing that kind of work. So in the archaeological thing, all of us dig Okay, we all start out digging. 4 years old, who is not digging in their backyard? And a lot of us quit that particular pleasure, which is, mind you, a pleasure of getting your hands dirty, getting the dirt under your fingernails, and seeing what's under there. But there's also something really physically fun about merging with the earth like that. So I got knocked out of that particular field around high school, I would say. In fact, sophomore high school biology class, we were supposed to be dissecting frogs that were had been stunned, okay? This is kind of gross. They were not supposed to be alive. And for some reason, my frog did not get the message and pulled its pins up and leapt off the table. Well, that it was traumatic, okay? Let me just say this. So I did not go on to archaeology. I went on to other things. Other people got knocked out of the archaeology field because they were aware of something that Forbes pointed out this year, that anthropology and archaeology are the worst college major. That's what they said. It's the worst college major to major in. Based on high initial unemployment rates and low initial earnings. And low late earnings, too, I think, is the case. Anyway, those who survived that gauntlet of discouragement and scientific requirements and ended up being archaeologists have had to prove themselves over and over and over again. They're a very special lot. They're a very hardy lot. And I found myself in a couple interviews describing them as like old pirates. You know, they've got the scars and they've got the swagger, and sometimes they're dragging the leg behind them from the wound, stepping in the hole, you know, stepping in the trench, you know, hitting it the wrong way. But just between us, I have to tell you that when I started writing the book about archaeology, and I was thinking this was a part of a trilogy, that I was really writing about people who were in the cultural memory profession, who were trying to capture things that that we lose in quantity all the time. Obituary writers, every day, people are escaping the earth, and all that knowledge, all that experience, all those fabulous stories, gone, gone. Obituary writers capture a few of that and save it for all of us. Librarians and archivists connecting us, obviously, with our written textual past. It's a huge, important part of our social fabric. They're not rewarded hugely with big salaries, but they do get an incredible amount of job satisfaction from connecting people with that. As for archaeologists, well, I didn't really quite realize it was a science. I mean, I knew it was a science because I got knocked out of a science. But when I started to do this, I was passionate about, I must go find the archaeologists. I must complete this idea. Have a seat. And I realized right away as I started dipping into the literature, oh, honey, you are in over your head. This is really kind of terrifying. But I guess I was like any lay person. And in fact, people that I know, highly educated people that I know, would offer to connect me with a dinosaur expert that they knew. Or they would send me clippings about a wonderful, you know, discovery in the dinosaur category. Or in the case of one dear friend, I was given paleontology Barbie. Kind of a very moving ceremony, actually. Now, paleontology Barbie has a little camp shirt with dinosaurs stamped all over it. And she has a little plastic dinosaur, and she has a very large pink brush. You know, that's, you know, the Barbie part of it. Cascading blonde hair, very cute little boots, and sometimes I bring her along to talks, but she didn't make the cut on the airplane. This is the first thing you need to know about archaeologists. If you're going to cover archaeologists, they don't dig up dinosaurs. Okay? They don't care about dinosaurs. They care about the human story. They care about anything that humans have touched, any place that humans have traveled or lived, any trash that humans leave behind. And what that means, I mean, think about what that means. All over the Earth, the entirety of human history, even in space, we have trash circulating in space. We got trash now on a comet, which means potentially a comet would be in the realm of an archaeologist's purview. All right? So, how many kinds of archaeologists are there? Oh, my God. You would go crazy thinking about how many kinds of archaeologists there are. I set about trying to, I didn't even know an archaeologist. So how do you go about finding an archaeologist? I read everything that I could. I read Archaeology Magazine. I started going to conferences. I signed up for field school. Yes, anybody can sign up for field school. It just costs money. They advertise some of them for volunteers. And if you're willing to pay, then you get some shots, because you're probably going to some place where you need some shots, and you take maybe you take some malaria pills, and be sure to bring your sunscreen, because no matter that they are interested in the entire world of human experience, somehow archaeology digs are always happening in the most horrible, uncomfortable places at the absolute worst time of year. They have terrible, the jungle. Okay, now, you think you know about archaeologists because you've seen Indiana Jones, right? And you think you know, oh, snakes are a terrible problem. Hairy spiders, awful. You know, terrible, you know, natives. My God, they're just, it's awful. Well, no. Snakes and spiders are not a problem. Occasionally, rarely, but they're really fairly stupid. Mosquitoes are the problem. They're just not very cinematic. Mosquitoes, in fact, are a horrible problem. I don't like mosquitoes very much. So I went to a field school in the Caribbean in the middle of summer, which was acutely uncomfortable. But what I found right away, in addition to learning how to sift dirt and do a little 1 meter square test bit, I also learned that the suspense of digging your little trowel into the earth was sufficiently captivating that it didn't matter how uncomfortable you were. It didn't matter what was crawling all over you. In fact, you could almost forget that you were frying under the Caribbean sun and sweating so profusely that, you know, your glasses kept fogging up because it was so compelling. What did we think we were going to find? Oh, well, we were actually hoping to find little shards of broken pottery that might have been marked in a certain kind of African style in the quarters of an old sugar plantation. Now, if you had shown me a broken piece of that pottery out of context, what? It's a broken piece of pottery. Who cares? But of course, in the context of that, we were looking for something that would tell us about the experiences of being a slave, or as they prefer to say, an enslaved person. Isn't that so much nicer? In the Caribbean, in the middle of summer. And in fact, we did find some really awesomely cool things. Among them, not any of this particular painted pottery, but some very fine little pieces of china. What was really fine pieces of china doing in the enslaved people's quarters in a sugar plantation? Well, this particular Caribbean island was the center of trade in the Atlantic in the late 1700s. It was so hoppin', and the trade was so tremendous that the people who were enslaved on this island were brought into the black market and helped move some of the fabulous goods that were coming through, earned money themselves. Many of them bought their freedom and bought plantations themselves on this little island. It was a fascinating story that was subtly different, substantially different, actually, if you think about it, from the story of the enslaved people on Jamaica or Barbados. It was what, as the archaeologists began to tell me, what they do best, which is teasing history out of the cracks, teasing the bits of history that just were ignored, didn't get written about. You think we know everything? We don't know anything. This was what I began to learn. Now, in that particular case, because it was about the Caribbean, it was a historical archaeologist, which is what they call people who study archaeology of the, I don't know, sometimes they say 18th and 19th centuries, sometimes they say post-Columbus, you know, they all have different definitions of that sort of thing. I would also go to conferences, and when I went to archaeology conferences, anybody can go. You just pay and you go, and good luck understanding what they're talking about. And I would randomly sit myself in these rooms and try to figure out, okay, they're talking about a part of the world that, I mean, I was pretty good at geography, and I had never heard of some of these places, okay? They find some pretty exotic places to go to. I stumbled into a conference room where people in the military had been invited by archaeologists, and there was they were working out a kind of contract that when the military would bomb in an area that was under conflict, they would designate no hit zones. They would try not to hit the archaeological ruins. It was kind of an incredible thing. And also at the conferences, I would hang out at the bar. Because how do you think I get people to talk to me? I mean, I can go up and just chat with them and ask them questions, and they'll tell me stuff. But really, 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 they'll tell me stuff after you've had a couple glasses of whatever. And whatever. In the case of the librarians, it was wine. Almost always white wine. It was fine. Well, somebody asked me, what's the difference between the librarians and the archaeologists? They have a lot in common, actually. Well, one works indoors and one works outdoors. One drinks wine and the other drinks beer. Beer, of course, beer. So I'm standing in the line at the open bar at the Archaeological Institute of America, you know, conference. And we're watching the bartender go pop, 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 pop on all these bottles of beer, right? Because they're all drinking beer. And the woman in line next to me, we make a joke about it, and then she leans over to the bartender and says, I'll have a glass of white wine. My sister. My sister. So a conversation came out of that, and we clinked our little glasses of really not very good wines, kind of sourish wine, as I recall. And we sat and watched the program together and struck up a conversation, and I was quite fascinated because she not only was an archaeologist who had worked in China, Korea, any number of other places, but she was also a writer. And she wrote about the archaeology of China. She wrote about the archaeology of Korea. And she also wrote about novels about archaeological expeditions from the point of view of a young archaeologist. So we struck up a conversation that is going to be, I believe, 3 years old in January. And I learned a tremendous amount about archaeology from Sarah Nelson, who is right here in the audience and whose fellow Wellesley graduates provided the fabulous archaeological-themed desserts over there. So Sarah Nelson and I met at a couple of conferences drinking white wine while all the crazy people swirled around us. And she took me under her wing, which I really appreciated, because I would say it's just a few years shy of 50 years experience in archaeology. And that is seeing some tremendous changes. That is seeing a profession that was dominated for many years of the last century by, okay, not just guys, okay? A particular kind of guy goes into archaeology. And I hope I won't offend any male archaeologists by saying they're built like Neanderthals. Beer, remember when I talked about beer? Beards, used to being in charge, sun damage, sunburn, used to yelling and, you know, marking things, and not very eager to hear people be asked stupid questions. And Sarah was very nice about my stupid questions, may I say that. The original title of the chapter about Sarah and my conversations was How to Pick Up an Archaeologist. And then I realized, oh, you know, she really kind of picked me up. It was so nice of you. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. So serendipity ruled our coming together. And Sarah was significantly nicer than some of the other people. It took actually me pursuing several of the people in the book over the course of 3 years to get them to tell me some things or to let me into their lives enough that I felt like I could tell something about their story. That was the other difference between librarians and archaeologists. Librarians walk around, if they are not wearing a button that says, how can I help you? How can I help you? They're oozing it. They want to help. Even if they don't want to be in a book, they still wanted to. How can I help you get some information? Let me introduce you to somebody else. It's bred in them. Archaeologists, paranoid, and with good reason. They are working at sites that many people do not want them to dig and that many other people want to get in and see what's there before them. And there's this rumor that there's treasure out there. Well, treasure, how much gold and gems really is out there? I don't even know because I don't really care about that stuff. Have you been to the Museum of Archaeology in Dublin? They have a room that's just full, giant gold balls, giant gold collars, they don't really know what these other gold things were. They think they were things that people hung from their ears. But they're just guessing. This stuff gets heaved up by the bogs all the time. Gold, gold, gold. And it's kind of boring, really. It's not really all that interesting archaeologically, I think. Though editors of popular magazines really love gold. Most archaeologists, and certainly the archaeologists that I followed, were interested in little triangle-shaped bits of stone. Interested in little fragments of pottery, interested in dirt, layers, stratification of dirt, interested in trying to find out the story of a wall that was actually built from stones that were taken from another wall. Okay, are you bored yet? I mean, it's like really unbelievably geeky, and that is what they really have in common with librarians. But the thing is, if you pay attention, if you read up on it, if you listen carefully, and certainly if you stand there with your feet planted in it, with the mosquitoes crawling all over you, you get an inkling of what it is that they're doing and what it is that they are contributing to our shared human culture. At this point, archaeology had some pretty ugly roots in, you know, I mean, some of the early archaeologists were really like Indiana Jones, looters. You know, we'd call them looters today. That is so not the message of archaeology today. Today, it is all about cultural heritage. It's all about finding things in context and preserving them as much as possible in context so that other people can appreciate them and figure it out. And my last conference that I went to was in Peru, and there were international archaeologists there talking about various sites in countries all over the world and how difficult it was. Well, I mean, you know, Machu Picchu is not a hard sell. How many people have been to Machu Picchu? Okay. I mean, you know, that's a place that if you haven't been there, you really want to go because it's gorgeous in this gorgeous spot. And it's made of stone. It's really cool. And it's got these terraced garden things. And, you know, they groom it all nice, so it looks really pretty. It's ruins that have been... Well, you know, they're wearing makeup or something. I mean, they're ruins that are very beautiful. A lot of the ruins that archaeologists dig in are garbage pits, or they're places that are drowned. They're underwater. They used to be, well, how can we experience that as tourists? It's not sexy, you know? What are you going to do with garbage pits? I mean, really, seriously, they are just not... Okay, here's a good example. The latest World Heritage Site in the United States, Poverty Point, Louisiana. Anybody hear of this? Poverty Point? Sarah, that's a good student. Poverty Point, Louisiana is, well, okay, I don't know how to describe them. They are dirt mounds. They are giant constructions of dirt made by humans. The dirt, they happen to know, came from really far away, and it was made by humans really long ago, way before people used to build mounds, they previously thought, and they did it really fast. So a group of hunter-gatherer type people got together and said, let's do something amazing and build a huge, 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 huge huge construction of dirt from way over there. Why? What? What is it? It's dirt. You know, I mean, it's like really hard to convey how cool this is unless you really sort of steep yourself in it and go, well, you know, why would they do this? And this is not people who were settled. This was not people building a place to worship in their city or build a place to bury their dead. Why? It is to dip into these mysteries is to realize how incredibly, infinitely cool the human experience is. It's to realize that your ancestors, they didn't know how to work an iPhone 6, but they were geniuses of adaptability and survival. And finding out the many ways that they had to express themselves, the many hugely unique and fascinating ways that they had to express themselves is part of the journey of archaeology, whether you're doing it underwater, whether you're a space archaeologist. Yes, a space archaeologist blurbed this book. Yes, she is quite a famous one, too, and she does these amazing things with, I don't even know what it's called, space photographs. She finds sites from radio satellite photography. It's cool. And this is the kind of thing, there are other archaeologists, they are tracking the loss of sites through these kinds of tools. They're noticing that in war zones, the sites are disappearing. They're being looted. And some of that looted stuff is financing horrible conflicts. I mean, you know, it's like a really, it is not just a very fabulous thing to learn about. It is also touches almost every part of the news. And this is ultimately what you should take away from archaeology, I think, is that, of course, there are wonderful advances in medical technology. You know this for yourself when you go to the doctor. Of course, there are amazing advances in physics and astronomy. We hear about those. They're finding stuff out all the time. And the past. Archaeologists make the news almost as much as all those other sciences because we keep finding stuff out that rewrites what we know. So, what I would also like to say before I open this up for questions is, I celebrate these people. I stand in the mud with these people, you know, and sometimes I even share a publication month with them, as I did with Sarah Nelson, whose latest book is called Shamans, Queens, and Figurines. I highly recommend it, along with her archaeological novels. And I would like to conclude this by inviting you to ask me a question. And may I also say, my mother is so amazed that I, of all people, ended up standing in a trench getting covered with mosquitoes, because as she pointed out to me recently, I did not even like to go outside when I was a child, which is not exactly true. I think she misremembers it, because I did dig up the backyard. But thank you for your kind attention. And would anyone like to ask me or Sarah a question? Sarah, I'm offering you. Yay. Okay, if you ask me a question, I have to repeat it. Okay. All right, so let's start this out. Would anybody like me to tell you about a particular dig? Would you like to tell me to tell you about, yes? Richard III, yes. Personally, I have not touched his bones. I haven't. And it's fascinating. And I don't know. I mean, there are books about Richard III that have been rushed to press. Richard III, Richard II. I mean, who knows? What do we know about kings over here? Isn't that why we're here? But anyway, he is compelling, and partly because poor man ends up under a parking lot, a car park, as they call it. I mean, that's just, that is not noble. That is really sad. But it's amazing that they were able to identify him, not just based on stories about him, but actually they've done DNA testing and have firmly established the maternal line. The paternal line is a little more interesting and actually calls into question probably some of the kings who were on the throne. It's a very interesting, weird development in this. They have confirmed, yes, it is Richard III, and they also are finding out that maybe some of his cousins weren't really legitimately of the throne. Might have been a little stray knight in there or something. Anyway, you can read all about it. Not by me. I am not the expert. I am the outsider who came in and was kindly tutored for 4 years by some of these archaeologists. Yes, sir.
What has been the outflow from the disaster in Iraq for Babylonian archaeology?
The outflow from the disaster in Iraq for Babylonian archaeology, it's been terrible. And in fact, it was the genesis for some of the reforms and some of the alliances between archaeologists and the military. It's just been terrible. I mean, these armed conflicts are a terrible thing to happen to archaeological heritage in any circumstance. But in the case of many of the places now, you mention any place that's in the news, there is a move afoot to destroy people by destroying their archaeological heritage. So there is an intentionality in it that is heartbreaking. And it adds to the paranoia in the field, of course, because you don't want to identify it. You want people to appreciate this history, but you don't want to target it. So that's really a problem. But the other problem is very interestingly being addressed by one of the archaeologists, a military archaeologist that I followed, a woman who works for the United States Army. She's a civilian, but she's been hired at Fort Drum in New York as one of their archaeologists who, whenever they do anything on the entirety of Fort Drum, she has to assess the archaeology of the site. And if it has a sacred Indian circle in it, a sacred Mohawk circle, then she has to persuade them, oh, you must build these barracks or this artillery range somewhere else. This must be preserved. And this is a great trend that is happening. And by the way, the federal government, our federal government. But it occurred to her when a particular archaeological site was destroyed by accident by American troops who were building a defense, that really education was the way to deal with this. And so she has gone about with a number of other archaeologists to educate soldiers, common soldiers, on how to recognize an archaeology site. What to do if you see rubble on the ground, broken pottery. The problem is that some of these defensive sites have been defensive sites for centuries. They were a defensive site originally because they're a great spot. So, you know, anyway, right now she's got, they've got archaeological playing cards out there for Iraq and for Afghanistan and for Egypt, where we had, we did maneuvers, shared maneuvers. And so things that identify the archaeology of the place. This has been standing for 26 centuries. Will it still be standing when we leave? You know, poignant questions like this. A lot of things are being destroyed. Economic development. Oh my goodness, what a lot of things we've been losing because of that. Superstorms. The rising of the ocean, the melting of the permafrost. It's been amazing what has been popping up, you know, in places where, you know, the hunter-gatherer guy up in the Alps who popped up, who had ibex in his stomach. They could see his little boots, you know. I mean, he had clothes on. He had flesh. He had organic. Oh, my God, this was just, I mean, and you can imagine how many archaeologists got called in for that exciting find and what they learned. It's just incredible. So every change that happens reveals something or destroys something, or sometimes a little bit of both. A lot of archaeology is emergency archaeology, rescue archaeology, mitigation. Oh, that's a sad note to end on. Let's have something happier. Wait, yes. Oh, Larry?
Clearly, you're very passionate about the subject of the book that you've written. My question to you is, did this, as you were writing and doing the research, did this spark some amazing thing within yourself? And is there in the future the lives in ruins?
Oh, thank you. The question is there a Lives in Ruins too? Definitely not. I'm so sorry to say that, because there are chapters that I couldn't bring to fruition. There are a million stories out there. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And I think, if nothing else, this book is a great companion to throw you into the internet and the world of archaeology. I mean, there's just a tremendous amount of, and I have a bunch of books in the select bibliography that are perfectly understandable by lay people, perfectly beautiful books by for lay people about archaeology that I found, some of them quite by accident. And stuff written about the archaeology of women. I mean, this is like something that Sarah Nelson really highlighted, particularly for me, is how much of the archaeology of women's lives was being overlooked because people just sort of rationalized it away, you know? They didn't, I mean, come on. It was fascinating. And, you know, that kind of stuff is really interesting. But no, I don't know what I'm doing next. The archaeologists were so kind, and oh my God, the bravery of those who put sharp tools in my hands. I have prevailed upon them enough, I think. Thank you. Kurt, did you have a question?
Yeah, about those tools.
About those tools, yes. The cool tools that I used in the field. Oh, yeah. okay, so because everybody has a Marshalltown trowel, and everybody has some kind of sieve, and everybody has a wheelbarrow and a bucket. I mean, you know, the usual things. Everybody has to have a metric little ruler, because you can't take an archaeological photo without something to show the scale of the size of the thing. Am I getting this right? Right? Okay. So one day in the field in the Caribbean, we were going in with this thing that looks like a surveying tool, and is in fact, I think, a surveying tool also, called a total station. Don't ask me, really. I mean, I think what it does is you carry it in, and you have to, I don't know, you have to do a lot of fussing with it, and then you have to do a lot of, you know, and what it does is it gives you, I think, a 3D picture of the area. Okay. Anyway, always the battery is running down. It's like it often fails them. Most of the archaeologists I was with, I don't know, they couldn't afford the, they did deals to get ground penetrating radar coming through. But the tool that I thought was the most amazing was an encyclopedic history of the 19th century that showed you how, for instance, a sugar factory worked, and it showed you all the parts. And Diderot did this encyclopedia where he thought, I think we need to show how people manufacture these various things. And that tool, that humble book encyclopedia, was the most amazing thing, because how else would you know what you had found when you were digging if you didn't have some sort of guide to how that was being constructed? Ground penetrating radar, I think, is probably the most recent, exciting, fabulous thing. But I'll tell you, all this stuff, I mean, other people make it sound like magic, and it's not magic. I've seen ground penetrating radar and tried to read it, because we were looking for bodies when I went. Okay, so I went looking for bodies at some point, because that's another kind of archaeology, is forensic archaeology. And these are people who are dealing with recently dead. And they work often with homicide departments, and it's pretty tough work. And they do the exact same thing that archaeologists do, but theirs has to stand up in court. So it's even more rigorously charted and recorded, and the chain of custody of these things is kept intact. And so we've got the ground penetrating radar looking for the bones. We were looking for the bones of pigs, but mobsters might have found some. Anyway, we're looking for the bones of pigs, and the guy's saying, okay, here's something, here's an anomaly. And I'm looking at this, and it's like, really? How can you tell? It's like reading poetry, okay? It's like there's a whole lot more subtlety to the art than, you know. I mean, you know, and my editor was asking really like questions like that, like, what's so incredible? One of the archaeologists in the book had gone to a site. He had bones that had been picked up at an African site 40 years earlier. And he and his crew were able to go in there 40 years later and find the matching bones. Okay? He said, doesn't get any better than this. And my editor said, well, what's so hard about that? Couldn't you just look at a GPS? I mean, come on. Really? Seriously? Are you kidding me? 40 years? Okay. Anyway, I heard somebody interviewed on NPR about this comet, which now has archaeological trash on it. And the interviewer was saying, well, what's so special about, you know, putting a camera on a comet? And this scientist is going, but it's on a comet. It was just like, sometimes it's hard to convey these things. Oh, boy. Look, more questions. Yes, ma'am.
You mentioned that pile of dirt earlier. Did they find any? I mean, what was in there? Why did they
at Poverty Point? Oh, you know, I don't really know at that particular site. I haven't visited. I only heard a talk about it and marveled that it was really even being considered. People were really excited about it, too, and I just couldn't figure out why they were excited about it. I don't think there are bones in it. There might be. I don't really know. And the mounds that you find dotted all over the rest of this country, I mean, some of them are burial sites, and some of them aren't. Some of them are like little hills on golf courses in Ohio. Yeah, on golf courses. And every Tuesday afternoon, you can go and visit this archaeological site. That's what we've done. Well, they named a dentistry practice nearby, Mounds Dentistry. Yes, ma'am.
I'd like to know what your position is. You referred to looting.
Yes. And, I'm against it. I'm against looting.
I'm an art historian, and I'm very torn between the positions of a lot of the artwork that are in our most wonderful, incredible museums in the world.
Right.
And yet, the effort now to return a lot of that art, for instance, Egyptian art, Native American art, you know, to the places where it was originally, you know, taken from. And I'm very torn because I know that these museums have preserved them so beautifully for all of us to see. But yet I can understand the people wanting those pieces back. What is your position or your feeling about?
This is one of the hottest questions right now and one of the most difficult ones. And it's, and you know, where it's spectacularly playing out is with the Elgin marbles in the British Museum. And, you know, if you talk to British archaeologists, I mean, they can be completely fine with you any 9 million other ways. But as soon as you say, really, does it really make sense that half of the statue is here and the other half is there? It makes no sense. Doesn't it really belong there? Well, no, and you couldn't have read it and blah, blah, blah. No, it's like, really, it's a very controversial thing. My feeling is, you know, a lot of those wonderful salvage, you know, preservation things were actually not so wonderful. They were really taking it. Sometimes, yes, there was wonderful preservation, and people were completely in concert with that. That was the old way of doing it when Hiram Bingham went down to Machu Picchu and all those things ended up at Yale. And now many of those things are at a little museum at the base of Machu Picchu that is down a road and nobody goes down there. I mean, it's kind of too bad. But a bunch of the rest of it is in a museum in Cusco, and it's fabulous there, and it's in context, and it makes sense, and it's their history, and they are telling the story of their past through it, and it doesn't belong at Yale, okay? Take a picture of it, Yale. Make a copy of it, Yale. You know, I mean, Yale. Yale cooperated. I shouldn't be knocking on them. I mean, there are people doing amazing reconstructions of things. There are people doing amazing 3D, I don't even know what it's called, but they're mapping these places, or they're mapping these items in a way that is fabulous and really is extremely difficult to tell the difference between the original and the other one. So my bias is toward, if it's not yours, you know, it's wonderful you appreciate it. And I think a lot of archaeologists are in a torn position because they are so passionate about a particular culture that is not possibly their culture. You know, we're all human. It all belongs to all of us on one hand. And on the other hand, it is people's identity. You know, it's like your identity comes from that kind of thing. And we have only an inkling of understanding of what that means when it's as old as, you know, our country's not that old. You know, we're mutts. We're people, you know, who are living on a land where, you know, a lot of the history of this land is not ethnically connected to us. So we're a little bit in an odd position from the rest of the world. The rest of the world has really got a whole lot of, you know, 26 centuries. They had stuff that was 26 centuries old in these places. Do you know what that means? The same people. Okay, so I think, I don't know. Sarah, do you disagree? Okay, and Sarah Nelson, I will say, for the podcast, agrees, but would like to add that it is very nice to have things in a central place where students can study them and see them. And they have a little thing in museums called borrowing, right? And so traveling shows do make their way around, which is how I saw some of the some of the warriors, some of the clay warriors from China. They were in a commercial traveling show. It was a little bit odd, but it was fantastic to be able to visit them because I could not get myself over there to see them in context. But I think that's really one of the amazing gifts of archaeology is that it connects people with their past and to detach it from them. And you know, most, you will know this as an art historian, most of that stuff is in a warehouse, is in the attic. It's not on display where people can actually see it and enjoy it. So that's my feeling. But, you know, I speak for myself and not for the archaeologists who are busily debating that. Okay. Want to have some spice cake with rubble on top? Thank you all so much for your kind attention.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.